Voices of VR Podcast.
Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR Podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling in the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my series of looking at different immersive storytelling projects from Venice Immersive 2024, today's episode is with a project called A Simple Silence, which is the third in a triptych by Craig Quintero that is kind of this fusion of immersive theater, one-on-one encounters, and 360 video. So in each of these different projects, he tries to pervert your expectations. And so it's kind of a series of different encounters with these different actors and these different situations and contexts. And it's honestly kind of difficult to describe. There's a kind of a visual poetry to it. And there's a number of different spatial transformations that end up happening throughout the context of these pieces. But at the end of it, it's trying to pervert your expectations for what you even expect. So that's what we're covering on today's episode of the Voices of VR Podcast. So this interview with Craig happened on Thursday, August 29th, 2024. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
My name is Craig Quintero. I'm the artistic director of Riverbed Theater, and we formed in Taiwan in 1998, so 26 years of theater, and we started doing VR 3 years ago with All the Remains, which premiered in Venice, and then last year, Over the Rainbow, that premiered at Tribeca and then was shown here, and then we have our third and final piece of this trilogy, A Simple Silence. And so we've been working from theater to 360 VR, and it's been an exciting change in process.
Great. Maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into this space.
Yeah, so I started off, my name's Craig. I was born in America, and I had a very traditional American education. And in college, I started being exposed to experimental theater and immersive theater, the likes of Robert Wilson and Jerzy Grotowski and Artaud. These people are really sort of pushing what were the parameters of what we can create through a theatrical experience, not just taking a play and putting it on stage, but having this different encounter. And so at that early stage, I really was sort of interested in, well, how do we create experiences for the audience, something that can transport them? And so I ended up going to Taiwan to study Chinese opera. And then while I was there, I started really doing research on Taiwanese experimental theater and its relationship to political change. And all of this led to forming a company in Taiwan, as I mentioned, 26 years ago. And, you know, really our own artwork, as I was talking about how these Wilson, Artaud, and Grotowski, these people influenced me. It was like, well, how do we construct our own experiences now in response to our environment and in response to these current times? And so we've done small-scale pieces in theaters. We've done large performances a couple years ago for 1,500 audience members. And each of the pieces, it's not really starting with a main point or this is a storyline, but it's really about creating an experience, an encounter. And again, with VR, it's been this process of like, how do we embrace this medium? With it has, its's particular elements that we can sort of play with and the things that we're pushing against.
Yeah, and so, you know, as you're talking about your own journey into this space, I'm just reminded of like my own entry point into this space was all the way back in October of 2011 when Punch Drunk was doing Sleep No More in New York City. I happened to go to a conference there and work, and then it opened earlier in that spring. But yeah, just looking at the history, I know that Punch Drunk and a lot of kind of immersive theater strands were coming out of the United Kingdom. And I don't know if there's an authoritative like history of immersive theater, but from your strands, it sounds like a lot of the practice that you've been doing with Riverbed Theater has been like a form of immersive theater. I don't know if there's the proscenium stage and then there's the kind of immersive nature. And so like, how do you think about the people that really inspired you? Where do they fit within this overall like history of immersive theater?
Yeah, so I mentioned a couple of the big directors who I did research on when I was an undergraduate, but there's probably the primary person who influenced me the most in the space that influenced me the most. In Boston, there is a small experimental theater venue called Mobius. And when I went to Tufts University for undergraduate, I really had not seen performance art. I had not been to see experimental theater. I didn't really know what that was. And what was amazing about Mobius is that if you went there every weekend, each week would be a different experiment. So some would be John Cage, a chance process where they'd be rolling dice or like choosing cards and then doing performances based on that. There were promenade performances where we started in the theater and then we went up an elevator and then we were climbing on the rooftop and going down stairway. And it was this journey. And each piece was like this radically different approach approach to what theater could be. And so no longer were we just sitting in an auditorium looking at a proscenium stage, but each piece was an encounter. And you never knew what was going to happen. And I think that process of destabilizing the audience was something that, as a young person, I really embraced. And this idea of there not being the fourth wall, of there being this direct encounter, direct engagement, a lot of their works, you know, fully embraced all of the senses, so smell or taste or touch. And so it was an amazing laboratory, you know, as a spectator, to sort of suddenly you're in the experiment. And so through that, you know, and I still, I can go and join a musical, and I can still like a traditional play, but there's something about these encounters where there's more of a direct engagement, which I find more rewarding, that I find that enables something different to happen. That's not just me as an audience in darkness being a spectator to this event. And so this idea of engagement, this idea of spatial transformation, of, we've talked before, so we have a history of conversations here, and so I don't want to repeat too much of what I said before, but, you know, of getting lost in the work. And so every time I went to Mobius on a Friday or Saturday night, you know, having no sense of expectation. And it's, I mean, an amazing gift to enable the audience to step into this place of the unknown.
Yeah, that getting lost is a really interesting way of putting it, because there's a bit of an interesting dilemma that I've found myself in covering your pieces before, where it's like, I feel like there's a underlying current of expectations, perverting expectations, send me on a path of the unknown liminal space, that it puts me into this altered space of consciousness. And then by the end of it, it would be difficult for me to like actually recount, here's what happened beat by beat. And so when I do an interview, then it's like, so in the last couple of, I think with the, at least the last couple with over the Rainbow, as well as with A Simple Silence, that, you know, I had the ability to go back and watch it again. And I don't know if by watching it again is actually like against the point of getting lost and disoriented, because it's putting me into this space of being lost, but also kind of losing the ability to have language to describe it, which for me is like terrifying, because that's like, I want to be able to like precisely describe everything I'm experiencing, but it feels like these kind of associative links that are sending me into this kind of liminal space that is maybe the point of it all.
Yeah, I mean, I'll respond to a couple of things you just said there. I mean, I love that it's hard to sort of put into words, because again, I think so many of our most intense emotions, our most intense experiences, I mean, that is it. It doesn't need to be translated into language. And so ideally, I mean, I love when someone who just saw like A Simple Silence, they take off their headset and there's this moment of just pause, or you can look and like they're trying to process, or they're coming back to like they were somewhere else, and then bam, they need to come back to, I'm sitting here and I'm in Venice and there are all these people walking by and I've got to go see something else, but they've gone somewhere else. And I think that the ability, like in 12 minutes, to take the audience to a space they've never been before and probably will never be back to again, I think is, you know, richly rewarding in terms of being able to watch again. But I do like that. I mean, to be honest, you know, having directed these pieces, I've watched them many times and in the editing process. And we were just showing Over the Rainbow at Bifond this summer. And so I hadn't watched it for quite a while. And so I was like, oh, I'm going to watch it again. And it was really... you know, things that were surprising still to me. I knew what was going to happen, but somehow it's almost like hypnosis, that you're sort of in this entranced state where, yeah, you again, lose yourself, or you're in this altered state where these things are slowly evolving and these shifts and changes, even though I know what's going to happen ahead of me, it's still surprising. And I think that because it's fighting against linear logic, or it's fighting against a stability of meaning, that it enables those moments of discovery to occur more than once.
It's like cracking those boundaries of expectations that put you in that state of awe and wonder, because you don't know quite what to expect, and it's beyond the ability to fully understand or comprehend, but it's like undeniable because it's happening. And I feel like with VR, especially in The Simple Silence, you're starting to, at least more than I remember, start to transform the spaces. Like when I rewatched it, I was surprised. I was like, oh, it looks like there's only like four cuts or four scenes here that are unfolding. But that feels like a lot more expansive, because within each of those scenes are kind of like a mini moment that could be even like four chapters within it. So like it's kind of like a fractal of like 16 different moments that transform in a way that's unexpected or surprising. And so when I rewatched it this time, I felt like, oh wow, this is actually like doing a lot of like spatial modulation in a way that is really pushing the edge of change blindness or other kind of like, you don't usually see walls moving around and have people hiding under this or that, or, you know, like things that are there that are happening that I'm not expecting. So yeah, I'd love to hear any elaboration on that.
Yeah. So I think, well, a couple of responses. One, in terms of a technical response, because a lot of, as you mentioned, there's In a Simple Silence, it's 12 minutes long and there's only four sequences, but like for one sequence, there's a lot of spatial transformations. And so in shooting it, because it's a one take, and so there's like, well, this has to move, and then this has to be the exact timing, and then this lighting transition. I mean, there's so many moving pieces that it's it's very difficult for the performers, and it's difficult for the tech team. I mean, we have the people that are building it. It's this fantastic scenic artist, James and Sholing, worked on the set for this Simple Silence. But all the other people backstage are primarily college students who've never studied or done theater or film before. And through the course of the 4 or 5 weeks when we're building the set, they're learning how to use a screw gun and how to use a pneumatic stapler and how to do all this. And they're really creating the piece, and then suddenly they're backstage operating it. And so it's so many moving pieces, but I love that. I love the handmade quality of it. And so I think something that's been difficult for us is, well, how do we translate the materiality of our live theatrical experiences into virtual reality? How do we make that handmade quality still be a sustained element that we can incorporate into the piece? And so when we're shooting, like for the final sequence, we probably ended up shooting that thing like 13 or 14 times because it'd be going so great, but then the tree was put a little bit at a slightly different angle, and so the light didn't hit it right. Okay, well, let's got to now rewind and let's do the whole thing again. And so it's a really, the precision of the work, the curation of each moment, you know, is very intentional. It's really trying to give the audience a fully realized work of art that's painting and sculpture and the human body and sound. But it's not just a painting on the wall that we're putting. I mean, it's all around you. And so we have to care to, you know, that fully immersive environment. And so it's really demanding for the team that's putting it together, but hopefully rewarding for the audience because of that.
Yeah, and were your other two pieces, did it have as many of those spatial transformations that are in this, or was this unique in the way that you were taking that idea of spatial transformation to the next level?
I think it's sort of been a common thematic thread in All the Remains and Over the Rainbow. And I really like this idea of, I think we've talked before about animism. And so I think that this idea that, you know, a tree has a spirit or a rock has a spirit, or that the space around us is alive. Samuel Beckett had this quote where he said, "The world is feeding." And I like this idea that the world is consuming, or the world is in motion. The world is around us and engaging with us. And so a lot of traditional theater shows, they'll have, you know, a set and they'll have backdrops, and it's normally something that's behind the actors and they're performing in front of it, but it's just a background. And for our work, it really is to give the space life, that the space becomes a dynamic character, and that space's relationship to the actors is a really fundamental part of it. And I think that that's not true just in our work and in art, but I mean in life. For the minor things of, like, here in Venice, it's really hot. And so when we go outside, we have a physiological change. And so the heat on our skin and sweat, and suddenly that triggers different emotions. And so without anything really narratively happening, through our body, we're having a different encounter because of the environmental shift, temperature. And so I think in space, in terms of our work as well, how do we enable the space to be equally dynamic, where it's not a passive background, but it is a character. It is that dynamic thing that's pushing the action forward. And so if the space doesn't change, then the scene doesn't change and we don't get to the next moment.
Gotcha. Okay. That all makes sense. And so I know in previous discussions you've talked about how it's almost improv iterative process of kind of figuring out the next moment. You kind of work up to that point and experiment a little bit. And so it's not like you sit down and write a script, but more of a iterative collaborative process where you're working with these different actors to see what would be the next step. And so this is the third in a trilogy. And so did you do the same type of process where you completed one and then see what that would take you to the next one? Or did you have a sense of how this would all fit together? Because I think you've been calling this a trilogy for a long time. So I think by the time you were showing All That Remains, I think you had already shot the Over the Rainbow. And so you had already had on this trajectory that you were on this track. But yeah, I'm just curious to hear about the trilogy nature of these three pieces.
Yeah, so I think that when we started the piece, I did have this idea of wanting it to be a triptych or a trilogy, the same way that I really love in Francis Bacon's paintings, that sometimes you'll have a single work, but oftentimes it's these three paintings in relationship to each other. And so with these works, and so again, each of those paintings has a very similar stylistic pattern, sort of like Francis Bacon. And so when you're looking at it, you immediately identify it, but each one is saying something slightly differently, or the composition where you're surrounded by or embraced by these works. And so in developing A Simple Silence, which was the final chapter, we wanted it to be a distinctive work of art that could stand on its own, but we also wanted to tie some of the threads together. And so there's some details, if someone sees the end of Over the Rainbow and there's a final moment where the woman ascends, and in the second scene in A Simple Silence, the same woman wearing the same costume magically appears in a different direction. And so you start to like, oh, well, did she, after this, then she comes back here? And so there's some of these elements, some of like the curtains. So there's some of the materials, there's some of the costuming, and the same actors. And so I think stylistically, there's not a linear narrative that's propelling the piece forward, but we're seeing these same two bodies in these different encounters. And I think that that's, when we think about, parallel universes or multiple realities, that these two bodies have been put in these different contexts, and then how do they respond to that? And so in a way, it's almost like an experiment to, for each of us, like how would we respond if we were suddenly placed, here we are in Venice, or suddenly we're now in Taipei, or suddenly in the same series of events could happen, or a different series of events could happen, but how would that change or transport our own behavior, or sort of that journey that we would go on.
Nice. And I remember in the previous discussion about All That Remains, there was a certain moment where you were like giving specific directions where you're having the actors hold two contradictory or incommensurate things in their mind and their body at the same time to create this kind of internal tension. And so I'm wondering if you continued to have that type of direction where you're having the actors try to do things on a little bit more subtle way, or there's always this kind of like unique gaze that the actors have, that kind of this breaking of the fourth wall where you feel like you're invited in or you become a part of the piece. But there's also this kind of like expression or gestures that are sometimes hard to place because, there's a lot of things that are going on at the same time. So I'd love to hear you elaborate on that.
Yeah, I think that oftentimes, because if you're performing a drama and someone is sick and you're there and you're tending to them, there's a very specific way that you would play that character because you're trying to communicate just that. Or if someone dies and you're expressing grief, then there's a way you express that. And I think in our work that we're trying to complicate the moments, so it isn't just a moment of grief or it isn't just a moment of joy, it's that simultaneously all of these things can occur. And so, like in the final moment of A Simple Silence, where the actress approaches the audience and then there's this moment of connection, it was a very similar direction of, at times it would look like she would be like sad, and we could sort of like, okay, yeah. But also, in this moment, if it's an ending, it's also a beginning. Or in this moment, if it's life, it's also death. Or that the ability to have multiple things happening. And I think if we can complicate that, then it enables the audience, when they're watching the work, to have multiple points of entry. And it's not just like, oh, she's sad or she's happy, but it's more through seeing her, I'm sad or I'm happy. So it's removing the locus from us caring about her and her emotions, but through her, it's a vehicle through which we can have our own encounter with ourselves.
And I remember when we were talking in New York City at Tribeca about Over the Rainbow, it's kind of like a bit of narration at the very beginning. And I think, I don't know if it's in All That Remains as well. No, that's also A Simple Silence, where there's a little patter where you're setting a context. And I'm not sure if there's much like narration even beyond that. It's hard for me to remember the specifics of your pieces. But yeah, I'm wondering if you could like elaborate on for each of these pieces, you're setting the context with what seems to be like a little poetic context setting.
Yeah, so All That Remains didn't have text at the beginning. There was in the second sequence, there was this, and the little girl looked up at her father, and with a big smile, she said, "One day, I'll be you." Yeah, "One day I'll be you." I forgot my own lines. And the father looked down at her with a smile and said, "You already are." And then in a simple silence that starts with, "And the little girl closed her eyes tightly and said to herself three times, 'There's no place like home. There's no place like home. There's no place like home.'" And somehow, and that starts us on the journey. And so, and at the time, as you're hearing this, you're looking at a framed painting of a chalk drawing of a house in sort of this fairly desolate landscape. And as you're hearing this, and that's the context. And I think if we said more, if we gave the next part of the story, it'd be too much. But this idea of no place like home, of home, of family, of returning. In The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy clicks her shoes and says, "There's no place like home," and then that's the magic that casts the spell. And the second piece is called Over the Rainbow, or Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And so there's these little threads, which when I started creating the script for A Simple Silence, I didn't know that that text would be at the beginning. We did it without there being text there, and then as I was watching it, it felt like it wanted to have one other layer. And so we have the painting, we have the environment around the painting, we have the lighting, then there's the spatial transition, but I wanted something else. And that text, and I tried, you know, maybe 30 or 40 different iterations, and then that was the thing that stuck. And so it's really, you know, thinking about collage. So like Rauschenberg's paintings where you're taking, you know, one image from a newspaper and then something from a magazine and then you start mixing paint into it or other, you know, three-dimensional objects. And it's this placement of these materials which didn't start off that way. And, you know, if I were to work on this piece for another 2 or 3 months, probably that initial text would change again. And I think that that fluidity of structure, the fluidity of meaning, is really sort of at the heart of, you know, this Just For You series.
And there seemed to be some pretty distinct color palette, like scenes that were flooded with red or white, or, you know, you kind of have at the end where things turn to black. And so wondering if you could talk about how the color plays into the juxtaposition from going from one scene to next, because it's such a, I don't know, it feels like it's like a Stanley Kubrick or very well considered aggregation of all these different set design when it comes to the colors, the color palettes.
Yeah, so again, and that's something when, in terms of the creative process, I'll often design the set first, and then it can change over the course of the process, but from that set design, we certainly start to rehearse with the actors. And without knowing, so if, you know, for the first sequence, we build this frame, and we have the actors will eventually be performing behind that frame, but not knowing what they're doing. And so we'll try, you know, Monday we'll try this, like, that doesn't work. Tuesday we'll try, Wednesday. And so eventually we'll find something and then we'll start refining that image. And with that, in the same way, like in terms of the palette, I don't know what it's going to look like in the beginning. And once we start to put bodies in space and think about the evolution of their movements, then the colors start to fit in. And sometimes they change. Like for the first scene of Simple Silence, initially the walls around the frame were going to be this really royal purple. It's almost like the Pope's, one of their sort of gowns or sashes or something, where there's like this regal, holy quality to it. And we tried it and it's like, I don't know. That's not the right thing. So then we had to go back and repaint it all white. And then we tried again. And so the scenic painter's like, "Craig, stop changing it." But if it doesn't work, then we change, we do something else. And so compositionally, and so there's one sequence in A Simple Silence where it's all white and just a few elements which are black, and then the performer's body's in the space. And initially we had a concept to do something else. That was just the base painting. That was like the undercoat. But then once we had the undercoat, we put the actors in, there was like the starkness of the light, the lack of the other, you know, sort of characteristics are we're going to highlight the old wooden table, or we're going to have like the wooden floorboards. It's like, no. I mean, I think this can exist just as like starkness and body is sort of on a white canvas. And so I think that embracing these moments of surprise or letting the script dictate itself, because I think oftentimes, you know, you do start off with like a pre-written script, and then the process of building and rehearsing is just, okay, now I'm just going to recreate that. And so the creative process is almost finished before you actually start creating it. And I think in our work, it's really fighting against the finality of that and really enable, as we rehearse, as we work together as an ensemble, to enable the piece to tell us where it needs to go. And so in the final sequence, in A Simple Silence, I'm not going to tell the audience, so if you see the piece, you'll be surprised. But there's initially we had built like a large deck, and the lead actor was climbing up on the deck, and then we had a little small house similar to Over in the Rainbow, and then he was able to do sort of like a headstand going into the house and then disappear, so his feet were sticking up out of the house and then sinking into the floor. Conceptually, I thought it was pretty cool. In reality, it was really clunky because we didn't have that much space, and then he kept bumping against his stuff, and it was like, we tried that for 4 days, and I was like, okay, that's not it. And so 3 days before we were shooting, we changed half of the final scene, which is kind of stressful, but also, I mean, it needed a change. And I think that letting that happen and letting, again, like the work dictate where it's going, I think is important, like getting out of the way of the work.
Yeah, it sounds like you do quite a lot of rehearsals before you start filming. And so for each of these four scenes, on average, how many times did you have to shoot it?
So we, in terms of the rehearsal process, we built the set for about 2 to 3 weeks, and then we had to take it down because someone else was using the space, so we put it in storage for like 2.5 weeks, and then we had to put it back all up again. And then we rehearsed for about 2.5 weeks. And so altogether, probably about 5.5, 6 weeks. And for the actual shoots on the day that we were actually filming, it was all in one day. And so each scene probably at least 7 or 8 times. Yeah. And if not, I mean, maybe 12 or 13, like the final sequence where it had so many moving pieces and so many different timing elements. And it's scary because at 11 o'clock we need to be done. And if we go over, then we have to pay the lighting people more and the set people more. And so it's really sort of time dictates. But again, I think that pressure is good. I mean, it makes us focus. And by the end, I think we arrived at something we're happy with.
Okay. Yeah, it's quite interesting to hear that process because, you know, it does take a lot of work to get to that point to, you know, put it all together. It sounds like by the time you are shooting, you have a pretty good idea of how things are going to play out.
And one thing, like you haven't asked about this, but I want just to be sure that for listeners, if you're unfamiliar with our work, I mean, something that's really important, like our theater company, Riverbed, which we formed in Taiwan in 1998, I think it being created in Taiwan, I think that the collaborative nature of the work, that our work with Funique, who shot the piece, a lot of people come out and was like, oh my God, how did you have the shadows so dark? Or how did you work with the lighting? I mean, a lot of it is really Funique and their post-production. They're able to do high quality work. The team that we have, Wang Yujun, who's the composer, and it's such beautiful music, and Alun, who does the sound engineering. It's like each of the members of the team is an artist. And I think that there's something working in Taiwan and the support that we've been able to get through Taika and the Kaohsiung Film Festival and the Department of Culture is that there's this really strong sense of collective creation or collaborative work. And so I think, you know, for people that are unfamiliar with the Taiwanese art scene or unfamiliar with Riverbed, I strongly encourage you, you know, to see other Taiwanese works because there really is something special happening there. And I think that, you know, for us to be able to leap into this world, and with Michelle and Liz inviting us into this community. So this is a third year in a row we've been here in Venice, and each time we come out here, it's really remarkable. I was just walking around the outside area, and there's this sense of like a homecoming. It's like, oh, hey, or a college reunion. It's like suddenly there's this community. And so it's really special to be able to engage in this work.
Have you been able to see some other projects here?
Yeah, I've tied the first year I was like so focused on like, okay, we need to be by our booth and meet people. And now I've probably seen 30 works, and I'm not going to see all of them like you, but I'm doing my best.
Great. Yeah. And it feels like that there's a kind of a unique, almost like against the market conditions. It's like a moment out of time here of just the Biennale and other folks that are supporting this exhibition. I feel like there's a part of the way that the medium grows is that it has a platform like this for innovation to happen and then audience to see it and then to get feedback and then to eventually get to the part where you have some more sustainable distribution paths. But you're kind of in a unique spot because so much of your pieces are so demanding of a artistic context. Like if you just put it up on YouTube, I don't know if it would like translate as well as if it were curated within a museum context and kind of more of like a festival scene here where people are primed by even being in the situation to have some sort of like expectations to have an open mind to see where an experience like this could take them into another state of being. And so I'm curious how you like navigate this dimension of distribution of this type of work.
I mean, I think I often think back to like high school and you know, if there was not a Blockbuster video store in my neighborhood, I wouldn't have seen the movies by David Lynch. I wouldn't have been introduced to Cronenberg. I wouldn't have seen Kubrick's work. I wouldn't have seen all of these. And they had like their little art film section. And so I think that as VR becomes, hopefully the market is growing and there's more opportunities to share the work, you know, I would love, like, I don't know if YouTube is the right forum, but, you know, that there is an art film section for VR, that there is a place where people who are interested in experimental work or experimental art, that they can go to this site and have this catalog of pieces and suddenly, you know, they're seeing something, you know, radically different. And so I think that that model, I don't think exists yet, but I think there's a number of different distribution companies which have been sort of playing with this idea. So that's really exciting. So on the one hand, that sort of distribution. But on the other, like, we're starting to work or in the process of working on this piece with Phi Studio in Montreal, where it's going to be a live XR performance, 10 audience members at a time. And with the Phi team is that they're really remarkable about thinking about what is a distribution model that's sustainable. And so for the Infinite is actually sort of financially, you know, their piece where you can have 170 people see it an hour. They can actually make money. It's profitable. And for a smaller piece like this, you know, it's really amazing their level. And the Onassis Foundation is also investing and Taika. You know, like these people are investing in something where it's not going to make money, but to create an experience which is sustainable. So we are able to bring it to multiple countries and share it around the world and to be able to create something where, again, we're able to reach a broader audience and have a more physically engaged encounter.
And now that you've created three of these 360 video liminal space encounters, participatory theater, is there a name for this emerging genre of types of work that you create that you self-identify with?
I've never thought of that. It was actually funny. When we were in college, people would sort of jokingly call them like, oh, that's like Craigism, because it was just sort of like, you know, different than the other stuff that they were seeing. I mean, I'd say that in thinking about what it really is, I mean, I think like surrealist, dream state, or like just an experience. Because I think a lot of other works are telling stories and they work really well in that capacity. And I think ideally in our work, it's trying to just create an experience. And so when we're talking earlier about like, well, what stays or what remains and what sort of goes away, or these ways that's maybe like later in a dream state, it'll pop back. But the experience, like just sort of, you know, in our lives, that there's this endless, a lifetime of encounters. And that through VR, how do we create a similar process of experience where through this transitions, through all these events, through these spatial changes, we've gone on this journey and it's become part of our life story.
Yeah, that definitely, I don't know if there's a name for that, but that definitely describes the vibe of what you're creating there. So yeah, I guess as we start to wrap up, I'm curious what you think the ultimate potential of this type of intersection between theater and immersive storytelling and, you know, this kind of performance art, experimental performance art might be and what it might be able to enable.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, having completed this trilogy, which, as you just said, is like three very similar 3DOF 360 VR films, and I think it was great to be able to experiment with it three times instead of just like, okay, well, our next piece, we need to do something radically different, and to really feel comfortable with this medium, to still be probing it, but also to sort of have a familiarity. And I think, as I mentioned with Blur, the piece that we're doing now with Phi, it's really thinking about how do we take this individual encounter and then have multiple people experience it or how can we have in a multi-user experience to still have the same level of intimacy, to have the still level of this whole series, we're calling it the Just For You series. So how can we have for 10 people at the same time, just for you, and to still have that same level of personal engagement? I think that so much information that we have now is sort of this constant bombardment. There's so much noise. And I think this, you know, the title of this piece, A Simple Silence. A lot of my friends in Taiwan, they're going on these meditative retreats where they go, you know, for 10 days and they don't talk. And it's just sort of to try to reach a moment of stillness. And I think that hopefully through these works, it can provide this meditative space or this transformative space to escape the busyness of everyday life and to just be. And I think that if we can do that maybe more often, that maybe all of that background noise can begin to dissipate and we can find stillness within ourselves.
Great. Do you have any next steps for Blur?
So we've done like 3 workshops, 1 at Onassis, 2 at Phi, and then we're doing our motion capture shoot in October, and then we're having our sort of final tech in January, and then it'll premiere next March 18th at the Taiwan National Theater as part of the Taiwan International Festival of the Arts. And so we already have a final date of when it's going to be done, and so really exciting, really nerve-wracking. But I think as an artist, this stepping into the unknown, I think, is essential. Because if we know it, if we've done it, then it's not an experiment and we're just repeating ourselves. And so how do we take the medium and push it forward?
It's always nice to have a deadline that can be a catalyzing to actually get things all finished. So certainly I think for festivals even like this, or even like, it's kind of a luxury to have a place where you know it's going to land, because that has a fixed context that you know it's going to be. It's like all of your final causation of your intentions and all your motivations are kind of all centered into that point. So yeah, it's very catalyzing to have that into the books. So
definitely. Yeah. And I think that for so many artists, Venice really is that focal point. It's like, okay, we need to be done by this date so we can submit, so we can be here and re-engage with the community. And so it's really a fantastic place to gather as an artist.
Right. Do you have anything else that's left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
We're also showing this work at the Kaohsiung Film Festival, which will be October 17th to 21st. And if you haven't been out to Kaohsiung, I strongly encourage, I think in terms of Asia, it's really emerged as a hub. And they also produce work. They funded Simple Silence. And so there's opportunities to collaborate with Taiwanese artists. And yeah, if you're interested, look up Riverbed Theater, shoot me an email message or Instagram, and then we'll see you in Kaohsiung.
Awesome. Well, Craig, congratulations for completing this triptych of the All That Remains, Over the Rainbow, and A Simple Silence, that I feel like each of them, my experience of it going into this altered state of consciousness, perverting all my expectations, and in some ways getting a bit lost, which is a bit of a not easy thing to achieve within the medium or just in life in general. So I kind of revel in those moments of feeling like not knowing where I've been or what just happened. So it's a kind of like this altered state, dreamlike experience that you've been able to cultivate with my experience with each of these pieces that you put together. So yeah, thanks again for taking the time again to sit down to help break it all down.
Great. Thanks, Ken. It really is always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks again for listening to these episodes from Venice Immersive 2024. And I am a crowdfunded independent journalist. And so if you enjoy this coverage and find it valuable, then please do consider joining my Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.